Welcome to Registry Matters, an independent production. Our opinions are our own. We are thankful for the support of our patrons. You make what we do here possible. And always remember, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 373 of Registry Matters. Larry, how are you on this fine Saturday evening?
Doing awesome. The podcast has almost caught up with my age.
Almost, huh? Wow. I thought you were only like 190?
Well, who's counting?
Well, you're the one that brings it up all the time, so I think it's you. Well, please remember to show your support for the podcast by hitting like and subscribe and 5-star reviews on your favorite podcast app, even your not-so-favorite podcast app if you want to go that route, too. You could leave a review in multiple apps. And it helps make a difference with the show, helps people find the content and all that happy jazz out there. So, what are we doing tonight?
We're going to cover this case that was initiated by the Pacific Legal Foundation back in 2022, I believe it was. So it's been dragging on for 4 years or so. I had actually intended to discuss a decision regarding civil commitment in Illinois, but the CAT case is so complicated, and to try to combine it with this case would be impossible, so we're going to push that out. And also, we have a letter from a mother in Florida to read. She's written to the governor, and I'm convinced that this letter is going to make a big difference, and I think the audience will see when you read it that it will.
And you think DeSantis will actually do something about it?
Oh, yes. I have the utmost confidence.
Very well. All right. I am a mother of an adult son who is incarcerated following an online sting operation, and I recently submitted a letter to Governor Ron DeSantis outlining serious concerns about his case and the practices that led to his imprisonment. I am providing a copy of this letter to you and other organizations that work to bring awareness to unethical sting operations and advocate for reform. My son had no prior criminal record and was struggling with mental health challenges and a substance use relapse at the time of his arrest. He was targeted while using an adult-only dating website. Wow, we've heard of that story before, haven't we? Where law enforcement initiated contact using an adult profile before claiming to be underage. While I do not excuse my son's poor judgment, there was no real child involved, no prior complaint, and no evidence that he posed an ongoing risk to children. Despite this, my son received a mandatory 5-year prison sentence and lifetime on the sex offender registry. Punishments, I believe, are grossly disproportionate. As a retired law enforcement officer, I am deeply concerned about deceptive investigative tactics, departures from ICAC and Department of Justice guidelines, and systemic incentives that may encourage fictitious victim stings over investigations involving real child victims. Thank you for your continued efforts aimed at reform, accountability, and public education. Your work on behalf of impacted individuals and families is sincerely appreciated. That sounds like every episode we've ever done with Kathleen.
Yes, and I'm thinking we're going to pass this on to her because of her expertise. And she can possibly reach out to the writer of that and see if we can get her some help. But I'm not expecting much from the governor. Are you?
I don't expect much from DeSantis in general. Okay, one question, though. Do you know what ICAC is?
ICAT, Internet Crimes Against, however that goes, I forget.
But, oh, yeah, Crimes Against Children, maybe?
Yeah, but is it CAC or CAT?
ICAC.
Yeah, Internet Crimes Against Children. But what's a little bit surprising is that she said retired law enforcement, right?
Yes, she did. Or is it a she? I didn't catch the name.
Yeah, it is a she. And this is out of Polk County, which is the county of Sheriff Judd, which everybody's heard of across the country. I would just about venture that no effort or criticism was ever leveled against Sheriff Judd until this happened to her. Now, that's normal, But when you're wearing the badge, that's the time to protest improper behavior. You have the most impact then. It may cause your upward mobility to not, you may not get the next promotion. But if you can say it as an officer of the law that this is wrong, there's a lot more credibility while you're wearing the badge to say that. Now, when you go in whining to the legislators in Tallahassee, they're going to say, well, it's because you're on family. You're not an objective person anymore, but you would have been objective had you been willing to speak out before.
Especially against the organization that you are a part of that is doing the unethical behavior. It's fine for all of us over here to be critical of it, but if you're on the inside being critical of it, that's a different position.
Indeed. Fairly confident that this mother, along with most, don't have any problem with it until it happens to them. That's the way we all are.
Yep.
That's not a problem until it happens to you.
I agree. So you think DeSantis will do anything?
He'll probably never hear about the letter, but I would suspect that unless they've changed, there'll be some kind of canned response from the office of the governor saying that the governor takes these kind of matters very seriously. And it will be looked into, and then that'll be the last they'll ever be heard about it. But again, I'd like to know that. I would like to reach out to her through Kathleen and find out if they do respond, and if so, what they say.
And, you know, your position, you have a lot more inside track. Well, the governor, I mean, especially of Florida, like, you've got 25 people in your state. The governor is a whole different thing. There's 40 million people in Florida. I can't even imagine that this would go across his desk where he would ever even see it.
He would never see it, but a staffer might respond under his auto pen signature.
Sure. Oh, no, auto pen. Do other people do that, too?
No, just Biden.
And did you hear the unclassy thing that was done, that his picture was removed from the president's list and the auto pen was put up there?
I don't think I heard that well.
Oh, my God. It's just so low class. All right. Shall we move along, then?
I think we can move along.
Okay. Well, we have this hot off the presses, and I probably could find a button to press here real quick. I'll do the news sounder. Here. Haven't heard that in a while, have you?
I haven't heard that since Narsil in Action.
So the court has issued... Oh, shoot. We have the court has issued a decision in the long-running Pacific Legal Foundation challenge filed more than 4 years ago. And you know what, Larry? We're going to get flamed because I don't think you said anything nice about it then and took a lot of heat for it at the time. The case is John Doe et al. Versus the United States Department of Justice et al. Now, we covered it in the past. Our records show that the most recent in-depth discussion occurred on episode 251. So that's like 122 episodes ago. That's more than 2 years ago for sure that we covered it. Now, my recollection is that the challenge included several claims, including the Attorney General's publication of new rules. Now, what were the allegations at the time?
The complaint alleged four causes of action. One, violation of U.S. Constitution, non-delegation doctrine, and separation of powers. Two, violation of the Administrative Procedures Act, or the APA. And they cited the rule, and they said it was in excess of statutory authority. And three, violation of U.S. Constitution's Due Process Clause. And four, violation of U.S. Constitution First Amendment.
If I'm not mistaken, isn't there something that has to do with an independent federal duty to register in there as well?
Well, that was the essence of all of the claims. True, that was the big one. It's whether or not there's an independent federal duty to register that overrides state law.
So, now, what did you say at the time? Because I want to compare what you said then. I want to make sure that you remain consistent with what the court held now.
I said, no prosecutorial entity has ever hinted that anyone who has been lawfully relieved of the duty to register will be prosecuted. I also said this is a solution looking for a problem to remedy. That's what I said.
Now, do you still stand by that now?
I do.
And what do you say about the independent federal duty to register? Because, boy, do people come up with that. Well, there's a federal registry, so you have a federal duty to register. Now, I guess you said I scoffed.
Oh, that's me.
Oh, somebody and you said us. All this was right.
Well, that's because I hadn't had time. You remember, we rushed this today. I scoffed at the notion of an independent federal duty to register. I went further. I said, if you dreamed up something here, which is my estimation of what they have done, because there is no threat of credible prosecution. There just wasn't, isn't, hasn't been so far.
Can you go back and tell me what that is, what you're talking about there, about this the threat of prosecution?
Well, the regulations that prompted this lawsuit were published at the federal level, in the Federal Register, sometime I think in early 2021, and there was language in there that certainly implied that you could be prosecuted because you have a duty to register under the federal guidelines, which many of the states' registration periods are less than what the federal requirements are. In some situations they're greater than, but there are situations like in Vermont, 10 years is not adequate. So people dreamed up this idea that if Vermont released them, that they would be prosecuted federally because their crime is a tier 2 or tier 3 or whatever. And I said nonsense at the time.
All right. Well, then, in your opinion, is there a independent federal duty to register?
No, in my opinion, there is not. But I did say there is arguably an independent duty to register that the feds can enforce when they have the requisite jurisdictional hook. That doesn't mean it exists, but I believe that they could have a federal duty to register. But arguably, that would only be for federal offenses. They could conceivably create a separate registry of people who've been convicted of federal offenses. But if you've been convicted of a state offense, there's just simply no jurisdictional hook for the feds to require you to do anything. That's the same thing when you look at your automobiles. You register them with a state. There is no federal automobile registry. Now, there's something that resembles a federal registry for trucks because guess what? Trucks often engage in interstate commerce, which creates the jurisdictional hook for the feds. But merely having an inappropriate sexual relationship with a 15-year-old when you live in Alabama, and that person has to be 18 if that's the case of the law, there's no federal jurisdictional hook for the feds to do anything. But the feds have created a jurisdictional hook when you cross state lines, when you travel in interstate commerce, and you fail to register. But again, my position remains that if the state that you are in, that you've traveled to, doesn't want you to register and will not register you are done because the feds cannot continue to prosecute you if the state won't register you. I said it then, and it's the same thing I'm saying now. There is basically very limited jurisdiction for the feds to have a registry that they penalize people for failing to comply with. They could possibly do it for tribal convictions, since that's federal. They could do it for military convictions. But state crimes, they can't.
Well, then let's move into some of the details of the case. Here's some background just to refresh everybody's memory. So this is from May 24th of 2022. Plaintiffs John Doe, so this will be Mr. John Doe number one, and the Alliance for Constitutional Sexual Offense Laws, ACSOL, filed a complaint against defendants. On June 3rd, 2022, plaintiffs filed a motion for a preliminary injunction. On September 28th, 2022, the court denied the first motion for preliminary injunction without prejudice. They filed an amendment complaint on January 13th of 2023, or sorry, 2023, and the court granted the second motion for a preliminary injunction. Now, what was the next significant action that happened?
Well, it has been kicking around for some time, but the most significant thing I think happened was on November 18th, 2024, the plaintiffs moved for summary judgment.
Your favorite.
In support of their motion, the plaintiffs filed the following documents. Now, this is the way it's supposed to be done. If you're going to move for summary judgment, you put in your statement of undisputed facts. They did that. They put a declaration from John Doe number two, John Doe number three, with and John Doe number four with exhibits. They put in a declaration of Janice Bellucci, the executive director of ACSOL, with an attached exhibit, and a declaration of attorney Molly Dixon with an attached exhibit. I'm not saying that a summary judgment was a great move, but this is the way you do it. If you're trying to get summary judgment, you do. This is the proper procedure follow.
And the defendants objected, is that correct?
That is correct.
Do you want to go into some of the details of the specific plaintiffs?
Sure, I'd like to do that.
Okay. So John Doe number two is a resident of California. He was convicted in 2005 of one count of sexual battery under California Penal Code Section 243.4. He was sentenced to 30 days. Wow, that's a hell of a sentence. 30 days in jail and 3 years probation. The conviction was reduced to a misdemeanor on December 5th, 2008. At that time, he was required to register as a PFR for life in California. But then on April 4th, 2012, Mr. Doe's plea verdict or finding of guilt was set aside and vacated. In 2016, the court issued a certificate of rehabilitation pursuant to California Penal Code Section 4852.01. Under California law, he is no longer required to register. And under the most recent available federal review of California laws, Mr. Doe number 2's statute of conviction qualifies as a Tier 3 offense, requiring lifelong registration under SORNA. And you can see the Department of Justice SORNA Substantial Implementation Review, State of California, and that's at page 23. So pretty good plaintiff, I would say.
I agree. That was a you don't get much better than that. Clearly, the offense was not taken extremely seriously. He got a very lenient sentence. He's rehabilitated by a certificate awarded by the state. You can't do much better than that.
So then John Doe number three is also a resident of California. He was convicted in 97 under California Penal Code subsection 288 and lewd and lascivious act with a minor under the age of 14. And at the time, he was required to register as a PFR for life in California. But then fast forward to 2012, he was convicted of a misdemeanor for failure to register under California Penal Code 290 subsection G, whatever. And then on December 18th, 2015, Mr. Doe 3's pleas, verdict, and finding of guilt were set aside and vacated, just like the other guy. And then in 2022, Mr. Doe number 3 successfully petitioned to be removed from the California registry under California Penal Code 290.5. He is no longer required to register under California law. And under the most recently available federal review of California laws, Mr. Doe number 3's statute of conviction qualifies as a Tier 2 offense, resulting in a minimum 25-year registration period under SORNA. You can see 2024 California review at 22. So what about him?
I think he's also a good plaintiff. So they're doing a great job on picking their plaintiffs. Don't have any faults so far.
You're not saying that in comparison to some other states that we've talked about somewhat recently, are you?
No.
Okay, let's talk about Doe number
four. Maybe a state on the eastern seaboard, kind of the two-thirds of the way down the coast, maybe?
Maybe. I mean, maybe it has a sister state directly below it with a very similar name.
I think we might be on the same path here.
So Doe number four is a resident, also a resident of California. He was convicted in 1996 of violation of Florida statute, and that's 800.04, for lewd and lascivious conduct with a child under the age of 16. Mr. Doe number four's conviction required lifelong registration in Florida, but doesn't everybody in Florida have lifelong? That's kind of a non-starter. But when Mr. Doe number four moved to California, he was also subject to lifelong registration in California. Moving along to 2022, Mr. Doe number four successfully petitioned for removal from Florida's registry. He successfully petitioned for removal from California's registry in 2023. He got off the registry in Florida?
I had the same shock you did. I've got to look into that.
Man! And then he also got off of California in 23. A federal government review of Florida laws in 2010 classified Mr. Doe's statute of conviction as Tier 3 in certain circumstances. And what do you think of this guy?
Well, being that he's gone through two removal processes successfully, I say he's a mighty fine plaintiff. So I don't have any complaint about their choice of plaintiffs. They were as good as they can be.
So then the essence of this case is the rule published by the Attorney General. On December 8th, 2021, the Attorney General issued a rule entitled Registration Requirements under the Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act. That's quote-unquote the rule. The rule became effective on January 7th, 2022. Under the rule, PFRs can be held liable for violating any requirement stated in this rule, regardless of when they were convicted and regardless of whether the jurisdiction in which the violation occurred has adopted the requirement in its own law. 86 Federal Registration at 69686?
Federal Register, but oh, yeah. Okay. That's the rule that's being litigated. It's the subject of all of this litigation. It's been pending for years.
Okie dokie. Now, the rule requires registrants to provide information, including the registrant's date of birth, remote communication identifiers, temporary lodging information, all passport and immigration information, information about where the registrant's vehicles are kept, and all processional licenses. Processional or professional? I think that would be professional.
Professional.
California has never collected internet identifiers from offenders whose sex convictions occurred before January 1st, 2017, and even in limited circumstances where it collects internet identifiers now, it does not transmit that information to the quote-unquote National PFR Registry.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say F-Y-P.
The rule requires PFRs to appear in person at least annually in their local jurisdiction for verification of their information. 86 Federal Register at 698885 and whatever, some other numbers. The rule also requires PFRs to report in person address changes within 3 days. Give advance notice if the PFR intends to change residences, jobs, or schools. Report changes in remote communication identifiers within 3 days. And finally, give advance notice of any international travel plans before the trip.
And with the exception of the last one that you read, my position was and is that these are requirements for a jurisdiction to be deemed substantially compliant. They're not imposed on the registrant by the federal government because, why? Because there's no federal registry. So therefore, they can't impose registration requirements on you when something doesn't exist. But in terms of the international, the jurisdictional hook just materialized because in order to travel internationally, you have stepped outside the boundaries of your state. Can you agree with me on that?
I believe so, unless you can somehow do that without leaving your state.
So therefore, the jurisdictional hook materializes. But a 2024 review, which is very recent, of California's compliance with SORNA by the Department of Justice found that California has not substantially implemented SORNA, meaning that since these requirements have not been put in California law, they can't be enforced against you.
Now, can we go back? Since this was decided by summary judgment, can you explain how that all comes together?
How that what all comes together?
Well, just the summary judgment piece of it. Can you explain that?
Oh, well, yeah, I can do that. Okay. So you thought you were throwing me a curveball.
Not at the moment.
As the court stated, summary judgment is appropriate when there is no genuine issue as to any material fact, and the moving party is entitled to a judgment as a matter of law. And that's Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 56A. The moving party that wants the summary judgment has the initial burden of identifying the portions of the pleadings and record that it believes demonstrate the absence of an issue of material fact. Now remember, the moving party, they're by making the motion, they're saying there's no facts here that need further development. Where the non-moving party bears the burden of proof at trial, the moving party need not produce evidence negating or disproving every essential element of the non-moving party's case. That's getting a little bit more complicated. But instead, the moving party need only prove that there is an absence of evidence to support the non-moving party's case. The moving party must show that under governing law, that means case law that's already in existence, there can be but one reasonable conclusion as to the verdict. When deciding a motion for summary judgment, the court construes the evidence in the light most favorable to the non-moving party. And remember, there was a case out of Alaska 2.5 decades ago. And the guy that didn't think that he should be subject to registration said, "Give me summary judgment." State of Alaska said, "Not so fast here, because we have this registration scheme to protect the public." And he said, "Don't worry about protecting the public. I ain't going to even brief that. You just can't do this because it's against the Constitution." So Alaska's defense was assumed to be true, because the non-moving party was the state of Alaska, and they were entitled to whatever defense that they could have presented to be assumed true, because all the inferences are resolved in favor of the non-moving party.
Can you remind me, who is who? Like, who is the moving and who's the non-moving?
Whoever files the motion for summary judgment is the moving party.
I gotcha.
So Mr. Doe wanted the judgment in Alaska. And he said, "I don't care about all this nonsensical kabuki exercise. Y'all just can't do this because it's against the Constitution." And Alaska said, "But we can, and we're doing it for public safety." And he says, "Well, stiff that up, you know what? You can't do this here." So therefore, the court was bound to examine that assertion by Alaska and give credibility to the fact that it was for public safety. So they had to take that into evidence. Mr. Doe caused that to be a decision of the court by moving for summary judgment. You would think after 25 years now of litigation in this area that the legal professionals could figure this out, since I was dropped on my head as a child and I can't figure out anything. I don't have a college degree, but yet they keep litigating and doing summary judgment when it's not appropriate.
So, Larry, well, step off that soapbox of yours. What about the First Amendment claim?
Well, the defendants challenged, that being the government, challenged the plaintiff's standing to assert a First Amendment claim. The court stated, while the court previously found standing to assert this claim, a more developed record now counsels a different outcome. The court went on and stated plaintiffs have alleged that they refrain from speaking anonymously because of the possibility that at some point California might comply with the rule and require them to share their remote communication identifiers, which would reveal anonymous speech to government officials and could risk their identities being revealed to the public. The court is not unsympathetic to the fear, but it is insufficient to confer standing. You can clearly tell that the court has been listening to Registry Matters, because that's precisely what I said. That fear is only in their head. Now, would you agree that they've been listening to the podcast?
I'm sure. I've actually tracked the statistics, and I have found those IP addresses, and I found those houses, and that's where they're listening from.
Well, but where else would they have gotten the information?
We don't have to go over that again. So I see that on page 17, it says plaintiffs cannot manufacture standing by choosing to take actions based on hypothetical future harm that is not certainly impending.
That sounds very familiar, doesn't it?
I think so. I was actually going to ask you to translate that, because that sounds like some kabuki legal stuff there.
Yes, but that was what I was saying along the whole time about some of these claims. There's nothing threatening you. There's no potential harm. But the court went on to say the rules The rules relevant requirement is that the DOE plaintiffs register their remote communication identifiers with their state. Here, that state is California. But California does not collect plaintiffs' remote communication identifiers for two reasons. One, it does not collect any registration information from the plaintiffs because of the age of their convictions. And it does not collect remote communication identities from anyone whose convictions predated January 1st, 2017. So therefore, even in the best of circumstances, if your imaginary boogeyman came true, you wouldn't have to give this information up to your state. Therefore, it was another red herring.
Don't suppose the state of California changes its laws and starts collecting this stuff.
Well, the court addressed that. The judge said, of course, if California were to change course and reimpose registration requirements on plaintiffs and require registrants to provide remote communication identifiers consistent with the rules, plaintiffs would have standing. So that claim went down the crapper with the other one.
All right, well then, I'm reading from page 16 where the judge said, quote, there is simply no indication in the record that California has considered, is considering, or will consider reimposing plaintiffs' registration requirements. Additionally, even if the court were to strike down the rule in its present format, the Attorney General could promulgate a new rule. Finally, even if the court struck down the rule, nothing would stop California from choosing to impose its own statutory requirement that the DOE plaintiffs register and provide remote communication identifiers, rule or not. California could pass a law. Of course, there is no evidence in the record that California is more likely to pass such a law because it is in the rule or because it simply wants to. The rule has been in place for years and still California has not complied, which certainly cannot be taken to imply that California is itching to pass a law, and it is only a matter of time. If anything, California's continued failure to into compliance suggests the state affirmatively does not wish to comply. And I meant affirmatively. That is. And that was all in quotes there.
And that's my point. It's been my point. It's an imaginary boogeyman.
So then what about the alleged violation of the non-delegation clause?
Well, the judge addressed that. The judge stated courts will uphold delegations whereby the executive or an independent agency defines by regulation what conduct will be criminal, so long as Congress makes the violation of regulations a criminal offense and fixes the punishment, and the regulations confine themselves within the field covered by the statute. Here, Congress has established the criminal offense, as under 18 United States Code, Section 2250, along with fixing the punishment, and the regulations confine themselves to the field covered by the statute. The Attorney General has not established under the guise of SORNA a registry for people with red hair who will be punished absent proper registration. Nor has the Attorney General required sex offenders to provide their shoe size to registries when there is plainly no relation between the goals of the PFR registry and recording that information about an individual. The delegation would not bear those exercises of authority, nor has the Attorney General attempted to exercise authority outside the delegation. Again, that's what I said. You can promulgate regulations if you have been properly authorized. You must stay within the contours of the law itself. That's how we kicked the Attorney General and the people's ass in Maryland 10 plus years ago, because they tried to go outside of the contours of what the legislature had adopted, and they tried to bring in components of the registry that the federal government wanted them to have, and they tried to graft it in by regulatory proclamation. You can't do that. But the Attorney General hadn't done that in this case. The government, the Congress, decided what the punishment is, not the Attorney General. So I didn't think this was a good claim, and the court agreed.
Well, then Mr. Doe number two argued that the rules definition of sex offender violated the Administrative Practices Act, APA, and sort of defines a PFR as an individual who was convicted of a sex offense. 34 United States Code, subsection 20911. How did the court rule on that particular element?
The court stated section 1203.4, the statute under which Mr. Doe to receive relief does not prevent a prior conviction from being used as an enhancement or predicate in any subsequent prosecution. Additionally, absent additional relief, that's pretty well tacky worded, offenders must still register as sex offenders under California law. Mr. Doe, number two, makes much of the aspect, noting that registration is not considered a penal consequence, and that penal consequences must be different than collateral consequences, which are not included in the 2008 guidelines interpretation. But a conviction's relevance for enhancement or predicate purposes is not collateral, it's penal. It serves to prove or enhance a future offense and to potentially affect the custodial consequences of such an offense. Because either interpretation of conviction still covers Mr. Doe. So the defense motion for summary judgment is granted, and the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment is denied on that claim. So we're running out of claims here, Andy.
Ruh-roh. All right. Plaintiffs argued that the rule and 18 U.S. Code 2250 together presume that defendants voluntarily failed to register until they prove otherwise, which they assert is a due process violation. It is undisputed that the Doe plaintiffs cannot register because the state of California will no longer accept their registrations. The rule, however, requires each Doe plaintiff to register and otherwise comply with the rule's requirements. And I've heard you pontificate for years about how a culpable state of mind is necessary.
You have heard that correctly, and the court agrees. The judge stated, in criminal law, both a culpable mens rea and criminal actus reus are generally required for an offense to occur. So, again, I know they're listening to this podcast.
Now, can you at least admit that this claim was a good one? Why should a PFR be forced to assert an affirmative defense?
Oh, well, and you are right, and they did prevail on it, but I can't really admit that it was a good claim.
Why are you so stubborn? How can you, like, you are amazingly stubborn.
Well, you're correct. I am. But the court stated the existence of an affirmative defense does not address the potential burden on the defendant who is likely to win but must still set his case before a jury to make use of this defense. Now, that I agree with. Conviction is not the only cost of the prosecution. Prosecution is a public ordeal, one in many cases involving arrest, confinement, and protracted proceedings. A person whose community does not know their status as a person who has been convicted of a sexual offense, in this case specifically because he has earned the right from the state to not disclose that due to his rehabilitation, and can face meaningful life-altering consequences and prejudice by merely virtue of being charged. So that a person could, if properly raises the affirmative defense and the jury accepts it, be acquitted, does not repair the harm already done by the allegation and the ordeal of fighting a case. I'm in agreement with that, and I'll tell you why later, why it's still silly, but I am in agreement with everything the court said there. You shouldn't have to face a prosecution. But the problem is, you weren't going to because nobody has said that they have any intention to prosecute you, any intent to prosecute you.
Then the court stated, this case presents a scenario where the bar is too low for the government to bring a facially meritorious claim and thrust a defendant into an affirmative burden to overcome the prosecution. That is not a proper balancing of burdens, nor is it enough to trust that some, or even most, prosecutors might never bring such charges. The rule's clear statement that a defendant is not relieved of his or her burden by a state's refusal to register contemplates the prospect of prosecution and necessity of raising an affirmative defense.
Well, now, that quote there, that the defendant is not relieved of his burden to register by the state's refusal, I have not seen that in the rule. That doesn't mean it's not there. It just means that in the 15,000 pages, I didn't spot it. So that I'd like for someone that is aware of where it is, I'd like to see it. But they did win on one of their claims, and you got to give them credit. They did win on a claim out of their four. They did prevail on one. And can you read the contours of their victory and their injunction?
The federal government is enjoined from prosecuting any California resident under 18 United States Code 2250 for any violation of SORNA, the rule, or any other regulation without first abiding by the following requirements. In all such prosecutions, the federal government must seek and obtain certification from the state of California that the individual was required to register under California law. In a prosecution concerning a failure to provide specific information required by statute or regulation, as opposed to a failure to register altogether, the federal government must seek and obtain certification from the state of California that California law allows the individual to furnish that information to state authorities.
Well, that sounds amazing, like the doctrine we've had on Registry Matters for years. If your state does not require the information, there's nothing the federal government can do about it because there's no federal registry. Therefore, like the advance notice of travel, if your state doesn't collect it, you can't provide it, and there's nothing the federal government can do about it. And I'm just flabbergasted. It took 4 years to figure out what was fairly obvious.
Well, you know that the courts move at the speed of molasses anyway.
Well, it was also, I shouldn't say that. I'll withdraw that.
Tell me what happens next. I'll get you out of the hot seat there.
I would say a possible appeal to the Ninth Circuit. They might do it just to prevent the award of attorney's fees and cost, because this is a relatively narrow and hollow victory. And if I were cantankerous enough and I were in the U.S. Attorney General's office, I'd be very tempted to say, well, Judge, yeah, you did say that they can't do, that there could be no prosecutions. We told you all along there wasn't going to be no prosecutions. There's so never any threat of prosecutions. So now they have to get a certificate. You got to give them. That is pretty creative as a remedy to force them to get a certification from the state of California before they can prosecute. But nobody was planning on prosecuting anybody.
Alrighty then. All right. So and now forgive me. Who would appeal to the Ninth Circuit? Would that be?
That'd be the U.S. Attorney General's office.
Okay. So this is, for all practical purposes, over?
It's over unless they are being cantankerous. Now, my experience tells me that they don't like attorneys to get hundreds of thousands of dollars of awards, which would be the reason they might do it, because this specific legal foundation, over 4 years of litigation, there would be, it's well into the six figures, probably $200,000 or $300,000 of legal fees, maybe even more, because remember, everything's more expensive in California. They might do it to try to leverage them to trim down their fee petition. They might say, well, we won't oppose you if you, there's so many things that could happen, but an appeal is certainly possible.
I see. But I mean, isn't a couple $100,000 just like, pocket change to a state like California?
Well, it's talking about the state of California. It's going to be the federal government. This was a suit against the United States
It's even worse as far as the amount of money. I mean, it's an insignificant amount.
Yeah, we're spending, $200 million a missile to knock down a $10 drone?
Yes. Yeah, it's a little bit more expensive than that, but yes. We spent all that money on these million dollar missiles, and they're throwing $1,000 drones at us, and they're depleting our whole arsenal. Which is humorous in a certain way. Did we stop the war yet?
I don't know what the status of that is. I know that the vice president's over negotiating in Pakistan.
I think I heard that some of the U.S. Warships were cleaning out mines.
And I would like to think that it's good faith negotiations. This war didn't really need to happen, but it did happen, and I don't think that we've achieved any objectives that were laid out to the extent that, they've closed the Strait of Hormuz.
Yes. 20% of the world's oil goes through there. Fantastic. All right, well, that was your politics 30 seconds for the night. Anything else before we head out, my friend?
I think we've done a good job, and we almost took up the usual amount of time, so I'll pontificate it just the right amount of stuff.
Fantastic. All right. Well, head over to registrymatters.co and you can find show notes and links everywhere. And you can also head over to fypeducation.org to try out the fancy smancy search thingamajigger that helps you search for where we talked about whatever. You can send email to registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Leave voicemail at 747-227-4477. And please Please, please, please. You know what? Hang on. You gotta tell me a quick little story, because I think we got a new patron.
Okay, we have got a new patron. I can't wait to hear that. So tell a story. Well, next week, we might get back to the decision that I didn't have enough energy to put together. And I'm glad this case came along, because I'm thinking, what am I going to do? I've got all this stuff to try to sort out on civil commitment. And lo and behold, this thing, and I already knew enough about the subject matter, I could put it together in 3 hours.
And what does that give me, a teaser real quick?
It's about a civil commitment in the state of Illinois and the two different methods they have of civilly committing people. And I was having trouble trying to distinguish between the two.
I gotcha. Maybe I spoke too soon about a patron. I think I may have spoken too soon. So never mind. We need a new patron.
So, all right.
Well, anyway, so head over to patreon.com/registrymatters. And for as little as a dollar a month, you could listen to this without any ads. You know what I'm saying?
Without any ads? I thought we wanted ads. I thought that makes money.
Well, we do, but the people that send us money, they shouldn't have to be subjected to advertisements. So anywho, that's all I got, man. And I hope you have a fabulous weekend, and I will talk to you very soon.
Good night.
Bye.
You've been listening to FYP.